Welcome to the Washington Independent Review of Books podcast. I'm Susan Storer Clark. Today we're talking to Clinton Romachet, whose recent book, Red Platoon, A True Story of American Valor, describes the 2009 battle between U.S. forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan. The base, which was in the Kamdesh district of the Nuristan province, was called Combat Outpost Keating, and the area is surrounded by mountains. The intense 14-hour combat cost 22 American lives, even though U.S. forces did emerge victorious. Mr. Romachet's actions during those 14 hours earned him the Medal of Honor. Clinton Romachet, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Susan.
Briefly, could you tell me what happened at Keating?
The day of October 3rd, 2009, bright and early in the morning, around 6 o'clock, the Taliban had massed in the high ground around us, around the outpost, and kicked off one of the fiercest attacks that coalition forces had seen in Afghanistan up to that point. Basically first contact, the enemy overwhelmed our perimeter defenses with machine gun fire, recoilless rifle, RPGs, sniper fire, small arms, and mortar rounds, and very quickly, as frantically as we tried to defend and shoot back and gain fire superiority, we knew we were outnumbered and in a pretty bad way. Within almost the first hour, with them overwhelming our gun positions, they had ended up breaching our wire and was in our midst. Shortly thereafter, we ended up getting cut off and isolated from almost 9 guys. And in the course of 14 hours, we were able to muster up a counterattack with some great air coverage and air superiority, coordinated bomb drops, and attack helicopter passes, and was able to push back and regain a lot of the terrain we had lost, to include our ammo supply point. Was able to finally push up and close the front gate where they had made one of their main breaches at, and then and finally was able to do a recovery of all the fallen heroes we had that day. And after almost 14 hours, we'd finally regain control of the outpost, and more importantly, had accountability of every U.S. personnel that was assigned there.
Weren't there some Afghan National Army soldiers who were fighting alongside you?
We had they called it a Kamdek, basically a company's worth of Afghan National Army soldiers, numbering right around the 30 mark. Within first contact, though, many of them had abandoned their positions and fled, either toward the enemy or toward trying to infill back on us in hopes that we could get helicopter support there to get them out of harm's way.
Nonetheless, the U.S. soldiers appear to have responded in a very organized way. The defense and the counterattack were well orchestrated. And the sheer bravery of the soldiers seems to be extraordinary. Is that your impression these years later?
You know, it's just a testament to how great this country has and their fighting men and women. The training they get throughout the military, the motivation that drives them to do their job, it's inspired by what we're protecting here back in the U.S. And importantly, it's more about the love for your fellow man as you're serving over there, and not the hatred toward the enemy that's attacking you that motivates you to get up and put yourself in harm's way to help protect and save the lives of your brothers and sisters.
Toward the beginning of the book, you make it pretty clear that anybody with even minimal military experience would recognize that Keating was just about indefensible due to its location and its position. Couple of questions about that. Did you ever learn why the United States chose to put it where it was? And could you also comment on the fact that two commanding officers later got some administrative discipline for their action or inaction relative to Keating?
You know, from my understanding of getting stationed at Camp Keating, the outpost was established initially kind of as a quick little stop-off point because we couldn't land helicopters there, and as the U.S. forces were trying to move north into Afghanistan with the invasion and trying to secure terrain, what was going to be just a temporary assignment to refuel and refit as guys pushed north ended up getting halted because of the war that kicked off in Iraq, and then you had the surge build up, and it was one of those military decisions that, you know, we held the terrain, we already had it, it's only supposed to be temporary, but, you know, temporary turned into quite a bit longer than I thought should have been necessary, but still, as soldiers that put on the uniform, especially now today, where it's an all-volunteer force, a lot of times, you know, you get put in situations that are less than ideal, but you volunteer knowing that there's a chance that, yeah, there'll be less than optimum days that you'll have to serve, but still, it's the attitude of, you know, I can't affect that, I can't change it, I have to go, we run on discipline, and I'm going to affect and change what I can on a day-to-day basis with the soldiers around me.
Mm-hmm. People who have extensive experience in combat say that once or twice they will run into someone that they call a mad dog, someone who enjoys killing and can't wait to do more of it, and that say that these guys were obviously useful in combat, but otherwise they're ill-suited to normal life. Did you ever run into anybody like that?
You know, in my military experience, I never did. But I do know, talking to my father, who's a Vietnam veteran, he had told me about guys like that and told me to be careful, as that was my third deployment. You know, I could kind of see, even in myself at times, that edge you started to get up next to. But it's still that mindset that what happens overseas needs to stay overseas. And when you come back home, you know, that's a different life. And to be able to compartmentalize is something I've been just blessed with enough to be able to continue to do. But, you know, I'd heard that advice from my dad to start with and looked out for those guys to make sure that, you know, when you kind of had a guy that you seen coming to that edge too, that you were there for the support to make sure they didn't cross that.
Well, teamwork is important, obviously, in that instance, to look out for someone like that. It's the key to combat victory. And soldiers often talk about having how much love they have for the people who fought beside them. And maybe it's the strongest bond that human beings are capable of. What do you think of that?
You know, I can absolutely agree with that, that when you're overseas and you're serving in such an environment, knowing that every day your life is on the line at any moment, you know, it could be your last. And you very quickly realize as you build that bond, you build that team, you build that camaraderie, that it doesn't matter where you came from back in the States, where you grew up or how you grew up, that brotherhood and bond is so powerful that you just come together and you want to do your job and you want to make yourself better because you know the guys around you are going to make themselves better, and you feed off that and you build into it. And once you get that teamwork and that loyalty and that honor and just commitment to do whatever and more for each other, it's an unbeatable force.
Early in the book, though, you quote some words that characterize the feelings of the people around you. It doesn't get better. Tell me what that meant.
You know, as we got to Combat Outpost Keating, and we've seen that simple little phrase scratched into that 6x6 header in our barracks, you know, you looked at it and very quickly you realized that understanding the situation we were in, understanding kind of the isolation of the outpost, the less than ideal position of it, that very quickly you just sit there and think, well, of course it can't get any better because we're going to make every day the best day possible. And we're not going to sit here and spin our wheels on stuff we can't affect. You know, we're not getting mail as quickly as we want. We're not getting a hot shower, but once a week. But you know what? We're here with some of the best men I've ever been able to be in their presence. And that's what makes the day the best day possible. So, of course, it can never get better than that day.
That's very powerful. But still, there are the horrifying wounds, the horror of combat, and you describe them very clearly. It all comes back later in memories, doesn't it, for many people? But you get through by bottling your feelings inside?
It does come back, but the choice is on us and to remember what we want to remember. For me, I and doing the book and doing the interviews with a lot of the guys face-to-face, the memories we kept dragging up was of the great times we had, remembering the life of Gallegos and Mace and Kirk and all the guys, remembering the times back in the States we had, remembering the times on patrol where, you know, Gallegos would slip down the mountain and would all kind of chuckle at him. And it was always the good times instead of sitting there dwelling on the hardship and the horrors of what you've seen in just an instant, but a realization and a memory of a life you spent with another man that's no longer here.
Changing gears just a little bit, in 2013, shortly after you received your Medal of Honor, you declined an invitation to sit with President Obama's family during the State of the Union message. Have you thought any more about that since then?
You know, at the time with the choice, because of, you know, just unfortunately scheduling issues, the night of the State of the Union was also the last night I was going to be there with my family, the family of the 8 men we lost and the guys I'd served with. And I'm a pretty simple type, and I just, as much of an honor as it would have been to sit there with the First Lady and just experience almost a once-in-a-lifetime event of the State of the Union, I just really kind of felt like it would be better use of my time to sit there and hang out with them and share a few more beers and BS a few more stories and enjoy each other's company, because we hadn't done it in years and years before that.
Sounds to me like if you had the same choice to make over again, you'd make the same one.
I would.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you've certainly written a compelling book. General McChrystal called it brilliant. Publishers Weekly said it's one of the best combat narratives written in recent decades. Are you planning to write more? What are you working on now?
I don't have anything currently in the works, but I do have an idea as time goes on, maybe a little bit more about the story of what happened afterwards, because that was only the third month into that deployment. And what was also inspiring was the 9 more months we still had in country. And to watch these young men, 18, 19, 20-year-old kids, first deployment ever, that it went through something so traumatic, yet was able to kind of set it aside and realize we could reflect and take a breather once we got back in the States. And for them to push on to incorporate the new guys that replaced such powerful personalities in our platoon as Kirk and Gallegos and Hart and Mace, to step into their roles and carry on their memories as we still continue to fight overseas for 9 more months.
Do you have a minute to tell me a little bit about each of those men whose names you just mentioned?
You know, Gallegos, me and him had some pretty long history. We actually reclassed together. We were both on tanks initially when we joined the service, and we had met up in Fort Knox in 2006. And I'd crossed paths with him way back then in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and we spent about six weeks together sleeping just a couple of bunks apart. And just his tenacity and just his overpowering presence at times to just enter a room and dominate was amazing to be around. And then for him to come to Fort Carson and instantly find out he was coming to our troop, to immediately go over there and start making deals to get him pulled to our platoon, because I knew what kind of an asset he would be for us. When Sergeant Kirk came to the platoon, I had never crossed paths with him before he came to Fort Carson. But you could tell right away, as soon as we got him to the platoon, his aggressive attitude and just his mentality of how to focus in even the harshest and stressful conditions was going to be another added bonus to the strength of Red Platoon. And to be able to sit there and have Sergeant Hart come in as a specialist initially, and see his potential as a leader to try and get him promoted to step up into that team position, to then have Sergeant Larson start mentoring him the way I mentored Sergeant Larson was really just, again, another testament to bringing the strength of the platoon together. And then for Mace, who from day one, I mean, you just couldn't help but laugh at just his personality and the way he just wanted to make everyone smile around him. His kind spirit, but yet also his aggressiveness to know, you know, when it's time to joke and have fun, but when it's time to get serious and knuckle down and not let things, you know, distract him or get in his way. Each one of those guys was just an amazing personality that I just will never forget what they lived for.
Well, your life has gone on. Your bios that I have read have you in Minot, North Dakota, but I'm kind of thinking with the bottom dropped out of the oil market, maybe that has changed too. What are you doing now?
You know, currently now, I actually had powered away from the oil fields on starting the book, just knowing the amount of time and effort it would take, and the company I was working for was more than gracious enough to allow me to do that. And in the meantime, I've been able to help support some nonprofits set on their boards to continue to push for veterans' rights, and then the ability to do some consulting for some weapons manufacturers kind of in between times of all the travel and working on the book. But being up here in North Dakota, the community and just the environment, regardless of how well the oil is doing or not, is an amazing spot to raise my family and to watch them grow and get enveloped in the community and all their after-school programs.
All right. Well, is there a question that I should have asked you that I haven't asked you?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
All right. Good. All right. Clinton Romachet is the author of Red Platoon, A True Story of American Valor. Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
And thank you, the listener, for joining us on the Washington Independent Review of Books podcast. I'm Susan Storer-Clark.